Thank you very much, Alex. So I'm going to bring, I'm actually going to turn a bit, maybe 140 degrees from what Paul has presented, because we're going to talk now about the United States. So rather than talking about equivalency and public health systems, entering into prison systems and providing adequate and often excellent care, we're going to talk about the experience that we exist in the United States today, which is quite a different difficulty. So no, I can't make money at this, but if you know of someone who has some money, next year I will have a different slide. I'm not going to bore you with these statistics. I mean, this is something that I'm sure you know, and that's probably why you're here. I will just let you know that I know about these two, and we'll move on. But just to say that it's important that more than $40 billion is spent on incarceration every year in the U.S., and a lot more than we spend on things like education and such. But what I did want to point out is something that maybe isn't so obvious and isn't so often pointed out when people think about imprisonment and incarceration and its relationship to the crime. I will assert you it has very little relationship to crime. That and I don't call it the criminal justice system. I think that's a misnomer. I call it the prosecution and detention system. And just remember, it's only one factor in determining the crime rate. Prisons have less to do with the volume of crime than the unemployment rate and the number of men in the population between ages 19 and 26, and particularly their unemployment rate. Only 1 to 2% of those arrested for property crimes are convicted of anything. And 20% for assault and 40% for homicide, because there is a body laying there. Most crimes remain unsolved. The likelihood of punishment as a deterrent ranks behind the unemployment rate and the young male population numbers in determining the crime rate. So if that's true, why are there so many people in prison in the U.S.? So we're going to talk a little bit about that. There were very specific forces that led to this state of mass incarceration in the United States today, and they began began in the 60s and then culminated in the 1980s with this incredible steep rise in incarceration. So in 1964, the right-wing Republican candidate Barry Goldwater said, as you see, history shows that nothing prepares the way for tyranny. You know, a complete, you know, strange quote, given the fact that we had a relatively low crime rate at that time. So this was just politicking. And at the time, the polls showed that people were much more concerned with civil rights and the war in Vietnam than street crime. But law and order politicians and the media began to shape a public opinion, playing on racism, playing on the fear of change that were implied in the anti-crime rhetoric. Then, of course, our dear President Nixon played on that card as well. And in his debate with Hubert Humphrey, his opponent said, you know, hey, let's put him in jail. This war on poverty isn't very useful. Nixon's good old H.R. Haldeman, who did time for his role in the Watergate break-in cover-up, says it much more clearly than even Nixon could say publicly. But it really, America returned to the ideology of 100 years prior, before which attributed street crime and drug use to bad people and dark skin color, not poverty and institutional racism. So there was not only this kind of political rhetoric, but then they developed programs and policies that were developed. The federal government, for example, poured an incredible amount of money into this crime fighting, with the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration. Its total grants quadrupled from $300 million to $1.25 billion by the mid-70s. Under President Reagan, a war on drugs was initiated. And you see his quote here, you know, a typical of Reagan, here in the richest nation in the world, more crime committed than any other nation, completely ridiculous statements without any fact. We don't want to reduce poverty. That's not what's driving this. Government is to protect people, not from the criminal, not protecting the criminal. You know, but very useful and gets people elected in this country, and still does, of course, you know. Academics fueled this hysteria, too, and got right in on it, developing theories of the criminal type and the high-rate offender that really altered, especially juvenile criminal prosecution and detention policies in the 70s and 80s. Before President Reagan's war on drugs began in 1982, opinion polls showed that only 3% thought that decreasing the supply of drugs was the most important thing to do to reduce crime, while 22% thought maybe decreasing unemployment would be a good idea. These opinions drastically changed as politicians, academics, and pundits joined this anti-drug crusade. Between 1986 and 1991, the number of state prisoners incarcerated for drug offenses rose from 9% to 21%, and even more in the federal system. And what you see is that you have this kind of generating incubation in the 60s and 70s. And then in the early 80s, if you watch the graphs, the incarceration rate takes off like this in the U.S. I don't have the slide, but I saw it twice today already. You know, so it goes like this, and then 1980. That. And so there was this incubation period, then the creation of all these laws, and then it slammed down, primarily, of course, on poor people and people of color. But there was also a lot of other stuff happening then. And because those locked out of the U.S. good life were living with few job opportunities, lousy schools, dilapidated housing stock, empty storefronts, disrupted, and, of course, murdered leadership. Lest we forget COINTELPRO and the assassination of Dr. King and the leadership of the Black Panther Party. I mean, this was two Kennedys killed. I mean, it was, you know, anyone who said that kind of talk was dead. So this was a very serious and important time. And I think of it as kind of a palace coup in a way, that occurred during that time. It was very brutal, and it was horrifying to live through it. And gang and drug-related violence increased during that time. Oh, yeah. You know, and people turned to other ways to make a living, and because seeing that they were locked out. And all of that played into this kind of ideas that ghetto life was somehow related to a crime and violence. But, you know, in terms of crime, street crime is not the most significant way people are robbed or hurt in this country. But if you ask the average person, they'll say it is. For every American worker killed by some thug, six are killed by their employer's negligence or malfeasance. In 2002, all the losses from robbery, burglary, larceny, auto theft, and arson totaled about $18 billion. Not one-third of the $80 billion stolen from investors and pensioners by a single firm, Enron. So inner-city police increased and became militarized, as I described, through LEAA and federal assistance. Neighborhoods actually were treated often like foreign countries where armies went in and did house-to-house searches. We had that in Fresno, California in the 1980s. Prison sentences were lengthened, parole denied to the deserving. And a few politicians would argue against the kind of prison time people were getting, enhanced sentences, truth in sentencing, higher penalties for the drugs that black youth were using, like crack cocaine rather than powder cocaine. By 2001, one-third of all young black men were under some kind of direct supervision of the criminal prosecution and detention system. So this is Pelican Bay State Prison, the holy grail of supermax lockups, the great totally secure prison. That X-shaped white building in the front, in the foreground, is the security housing unit. 1,056 solitary confinement cells arranged in 8 cell pods, each one separated from the other, from all the other pods that make up that unit. It's like an underground bunker. No one ever sees the sun. And there are 1,056 men locked up there. My friend Todd has been there, a guy who hired me a couple of times to successfully sue the department for medical neglect, hopeless medical neglect on a constitutional basis. He's been there since 1989. He's not getting out. He was just on hunger strike. Maybe you heard about the California hunger strike. It was those characters, these guys inside there risking their lives for our human rights, hunger striking twice in, and I told them not to do it. I told them you have to have 16 weeks between each hunger strike to rebuild your body, and you know, that's it. And you know, he didn't listen. He just wrote me a letter, Corey, we gotta do it, you know. So he did, and they actually are, hopefully will win some reforms. And while they're not my heroes by any stretch of the imagination, they are acting heroically. But back to the real point of this talk, about prisons doing more harm than good. So with more than 2 million behind bars, is the U.S. safer in this era of mass incarceration and warehouse prisons like Pelican Bay? If the crime rates tell the story, then we're worse off. We have higher crime rates in all index crimes than when the right-wing anti-crime effort began in the 1960s. In fact, the mass incarceration program creates more harm than crimes from which it is supposed to protect us, I will assert. Even the stated purpose of prisons has changed over the last 50 years. Before the political shift in the mid-1970s, rehabilitation was the goal. And since then, it has been changed to first containment, and more recently, incapacitation. Now, incapacitation, it sounds horrible. It sounds like, you know, you're going to break a person's arms and legs. But I mean, to the political scientist, it means we're going to keep him inside, you know, out of society. But, you know, it sounds more kind of vicious than that, doesn't it? In 2002, the Bureau of Justice Statistics released a study showing that 52% of prisoners were returned to prison within 3 years of being released. Most prisoners come to prison from poverty and upon release return to increasingly impoverished communities. 2005 census data showed that 16 million Americans were living in severe poverty with less than $5,080 for a family of four. The census found that severe poverty increased 26% more than the overall growth in poverty. In 2002, 43% of the nation's poor were living in severe poverty, the highest rate since 1975, when the social safety net was unraveled by lawmakers as part of a Blame the Poor campaign. So prisoners are impoverished in prison, in warehouse prisons, but then have the opportunity to do what? Return to communities that are more devastated than even when they left. These last three slides of this severe overcrowding in California. And I'll just mention that you may have heard that there was a Supreme Court decision over medical care that said that it was indeed unconstitutional for California to house as many prisons in these kinds of triple bunk overcrowded conditions because it kills them through lack of medical care. And that was the decision. Supreme Court said, yes, that's right, and you have to reduce your prison's population. And the politicians and the administrators in California have managed to go through even that decision. This is going on for now a decade. And they have not released one prisoner from prison. And they will not release one prisoner from prison. Not one will be released. They will reduce prison size by not taking in as many and throwing them on the county jails to take care of. That's how it's going to be done. It's called adjustment. You know, but so that these it's amazing to me that they can figure out how to resist the federal court and common sense and decency and not release one person, so that no politician will ever be accused of releasing one person from prison. That's really what it's about. We're in a strange time. All right. Well, let's talk about health. All right. So prisoners, as you know, bring to prison high rates of these, especially particularly these kinds of conditions. And despite decades of legal action by prisoners and human rights advocates, governments still have not allocated adequate money for treatment inside and organized coherent services to care for prisoners' real needs. And as Paul was saying, often the custodial providers adopt the medical providers adopt custodial attitudes. I will give just one example of the bizarre nature of this, if I have time, which is that in California we have a endemic illness that breaks out every spring and summer called valley fever, coccidiomycosis, where these spores of the fungus are in the soils. And when those southern winds come in to the Central Valley in California and stirs up the dust, these spores come into people's nostrils and people get sick. If you live in the Central Valley, well, you're okay, you know, and someone gets sick in an endemic, you know, illness like that. But by and large, you get immunized slowly over time, and you get most people, it feels like a cold, maybe it feels like the flu, and then your immune system copes with it. But if you're a prisoner, especially if you're African-American, Pacific Islander, who are particularly susceptible to the ill effects of this illness, and you're plunked down in the middle of it in a prison for the first time, you might get sick. And in fact, in California, African-Americans and Asian Pacific Islanders are particularly susceptible. There are more than 670 cases of infection in 06 in the Valley prisons. One prison, Pleasant Valley in Coalinga, California, experienced a 10% rate of infection. Prisoners made up two-thirds of the valley fever cases in two Central Valley counties. Four men died from the disease. Treatment services were chaotic, slow, resulting in increased morbidity for the stricken. Despite this public health crisis, prison administrators have made only recent and very modest adjustments in policies concerning placements of at-risk individuals into hyperendemic facilities. There are even more plans to build prisons in the Valley. And rather than change prison placement strategies, California prison managers publicly hoped in press, on camera, for the creation of a vaccine against Valley fever as the solution to this problem. I won't go into something that's covered more often in this conference about rates of HIV, Hep C, and the need for condom distribution, needle exchange, safe tattoo kits, and opiate substitution measures that are not available in almost any prisons in the United States. They are available in the opiate substitution program in New Mexico. And we bless the director of health services there for creating this, you know, kind of model program in the U.S. But there are whole countries. Spain has opiate substitution, needle exchange, you know, and they've reduced their in-prison transmission of Hep C and HIV to almost zero. And we just keep on going. What about mental health? Well, 20% of the prisoners have serious psychiatric diagnoses. And some people believe that it was in the 1960s when they collapsed the state mental hospital system and then didn't fund the community care system that then put that burden onto the prisons and jails. And I think there is some evidence of that. But prison itself... And treatment is often not adequate. But I think prison itself has a debilitating effect on prisoners. And I would urge you to look up John Irwin's book, Dr. John, the Olive Sholem John died last year, but he was a great ex-con, rose to the department head, became the director of sociology, the head of sociology at San Francisco State University. And always when he went and did his social, anthropological, sociological studies on prisoners, he always did one thing. He went and talked to the prisoners, wrote down what they said. And he was great. And, you know, so you get a certain really level of reality in all of John's work. And his book, The Warehouse Prison, is an amazing work. And I recommend it to all of you. If you want to understand what ordinary prison life is and what it does to prisoners in America, that's the book to read. It's incredible. And a lot of what I'm talking about is from John's work. Well, what he learned from the prisoners at this Level 3 medium security facility in Solano, California, CSP Solano, is that prisoners develop difficulty in acting independently on their behalf. Prison life is one of petty rules and little opportunity at self-management. Even the underground prison economy is largely controlled by large, rigid organizations, gangs. Now, there's really not a, and there's not a lot of other stuff that people get to develop themselves. Their sense of self becomes diminished. There's no privacy. The environment is threatening, both by staff and other prisoners. They develop there's a change in sexual orientation. Prison is a place of exaggerated machismo with frequent sexual predation. Some long-term heterosexual prisoners resort to same-sex affairs that remain hidden from their outside families. Homosexuals and young defenseless men are used for sex. This all occurs with little regard for safer sex and with rare access to harm reduction tools. And prisoners develop an anger at injustice. They know what's going on. They know who they are. They know they're undereducated. They know they lack employable skills. And they are well aware that they have little chance of acquiring any of that in prison. And there's lots of injustice at these overly lengthy sentences and parole denials and the idiocy of prison discipline, rules being arbitrarily enforced and the administrative appeals process usually a sham. In many facilities, the day-to-day application of rules supports the power and prejudice of staff and the underground economy as much as it holds up the safety and smooth running of the prison. Misery is an important part, an important result of incarceration. From arrest and trial to incarceration, prisoners are treated with hostility and contempt, causing depression and a sense of unworthiness. As the months and years go by, many reject conventional society and embrace the outsider criminal point of view. Prisoners adopt the mores of prison, where they learn racial prejudice and homophobia. They adopt the vocabulary, mannerisms, and grooming standards of the prison culture. Simple programs like literacy are often not available. In prisons, 19% are illiterate, and up to 60% functionally illiterate, a rate 5 times the general population. There's a California law. You can tell I'm from California. California law mandates that all illiterate prisoners are educated to literacy. That law is completely ignored. Only 6% of California prisoners are in academic programs or classes, academic classes, and 5% in vocational programs. And prisoners believe they are just cogs in the prison industrial complex. They know they are, you know, and they talk about it in that way. So just to summarize, kind of in what way these harms have occurred. Well, there's first diversion of tax money to prisons. Could go to education, could go to rebuilding communities, could go to a lot of things, but it goes to prisons. The families and social fabric of prison communities are disrupted. Dads and moms are gone, increasingly moms. Prison culture has a deeper impact on the community. So in those communities from which prisoners come and to which they return after very long sentences, having been habituated to prison life and the mores and ethics and behaviors of prison culture, they come back and it has a deeper impact on the community. And prisoners are disenfranchised through literacy, employment, voting rights. 46 states do prohibit voting of some kind. And there's a sense of just you know, social vindictiveness in the land. Prisons are socially vindictive. Personal and security and safety concerns, and I call them delusions. I mean, all these middle-class people who say, you know, I have to protect myself against, you are not being robbed. You're being robbed by Enron and the Bank of America. And, you know, the people with money are taking your money, and the people without money are taking the money of the people without money. You know, that's what street crime is, and it's ridiculous. You know, this kind of, I have to live behind a gate. What are you talking about? It's a delusion. And a delusion that has such a solid reality that it's scary. So the health of the public is ignored and prisoners released to community increasingly not equipped to assist them. Again, I give you Dr. Irwin's wonderful book. Please pick it up. And then if you want to know more about the kind of institutional aspects of incarceration, Craig Haney is your author. He's amazing and a wonderful guy and writes well on these. Thank you very much. We'll take questions afterwards.